Hello and welcome to the Primal MMA Coaching Podcast, an exploration of the training and development within mixed martial arts. My name is Scott Sivright, and together with my guests, we will discuss how the science of coaching, skill acquisition, and human motivation can help us design practice more effectively. No matter what your martial arts goals are, you surely all want to be better. So, let's try to be better at getting better. Okay, well, today I am introducing two guests to the conversation. That is Dr. Julia Blau and Dr. Jeffrey Wagman. Dr. Blau is an associate professor at Central Connecticut State University, where she teaches and researches in the development of psychological science. Dr. Wagman is a professor of psychology at the Illinois State University, where he teaches and researches. Both Professors Blau and Wagman join me to discuss their recently published new book, An Introduction into Ecological Psychology. So this is episode 28 of the podcast, and each conversation I've had in the last couple of years has helped me better understand skill development and movement more generally through an ecological lens. Now, shaking off old understandings and ingrained intuitions has been quite the challenge for me, but then the whole purpose of this podcast was to investigate and explore the research and the science that can inform and help me create better practice environments. Some really strong intuitions and beliefs are really still hard to let go of, and these include the role of memory, of knowledge, mental representations, and indeed the feeling of being wholly in charge of ourselves and our actions. Blau and Wagman's book really helped me tie up some of the loose ends here, and some of my lingering doubts and issues were put to rest. I really loved the structure and the narrative of the book, much of it conceptualized through the perspective of Fred, who is the book's lead character, and how he moves and interacts with the world. The book was supported with reference studies and experimental research, and I really feel the authors did a fine job of presenting the evidence in an easy reading format for a non-academic audience. As I've spoke about many times before, getting the research out of the labs and onto the mats is not easy, given that coaches and academics seem to be in different circles and talk different languages. This seems to be far from ideal, as there's an absolute treasure trove of research out there that can help inform and support us sports coaches and practitioners. In this conversation, there really wasn't much talking about martial arts, but rather we discussed some of the key concepts of the book, and both Julie and Jeff helped me better understand a few ideas that I've been struggling with. We spoke about the role of the central executive, where intentions and meaning seem to come from, the role of memory, and how our behaviours emerge from complex, dynamic interactions with our environment and experiences. For anyone who is interested in digging a little deeper into an ecological approach for sport, or even just likes to read about the fascinating science of psychology, this book is very much worth adding to your library. Dr. Wagman and Blau also recently appeared on the terrific Rob Gray's Perception Action podcast, which I implore anyone involved with sports coaching to check out if you haven't already. And as always, should you want to reach out or follow up with either of today's guests, you can find their contact information and bio links in the episode's description. Lastly, the recent episodes I did with Coach Greg Souders were very well received. Greg recently spoke with my buddy Josh Peacock on his poddy, the Combat Learning Podcast, in the aptly named episode Drilling is a Waste of Time. So if you enjoyed listening to Greg on here, you should check him out on the CLP too. Once again, thank you for all who listen and support. Now, without further blathering for me, on with the show. Okay, listener or listeners, please welcome Dr. Blau and Dr. Wagman. Doctors, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks.
Great, thanks.
Okay, so this is a special treat for me and something I've been looking forward to, and a little different from the guests I normally interview on the podcast. You both have just written and recently published an absolutely terrific book that it's not a superlative to say it has had a profound impact on the way I not only see my sport, but the way I see my life. Now, I have been in the ecological space for several years now and trying to apply it to my sport. And I had a lot of hard, deep, ingrained intuitions and beliefs that I've been struggling with. And this book did a tremendous job of tying up some of these loose ends and giving me a bit more reassurance. So we're going to talk a little bit about that today. Please feel free to geek out as much as possible. I love it. If I have to go back to my books and decipher it later on, that's great. So don't hold back on me whatsoever. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds great. And thank you so much for your kind, kind words.
I was going to say, that's the nicest introduction we've ever gotten.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, if I've done one thing right, it might be the intro. So again, so the book is An Introduction to Ecological Psychology. Now, we throw around the word, especially in my gym and my environment and my circle, of ecological dynamics. And that can just come off as a little bit buzzwordy. But again, I'd like to just maybe flesh out a couple of the features and how it pertains to my sport. And I will give a fluffy intro in the bio, which I'll record retrospectively, like I said. But perhaps just talk me in a few brief words why you wrote the book and what brought you to writing the book. Go ahead.
So we worked together on a project prior to this. We had done an edited volume together and we had a good time. And we were sitting around thinking, we should do something else. That was fun. And we were talking about, like, what does the field need? What would be useful? What is something that people would want? And just the idea of the intro text was just there and ready, because people have been talking about it for years, about how this is the thing that that needs to be done, but nobody, you know, did it. And so this was us. This is why we decided to do it, was because it was necessary in the field and it would be a fun project for us to do together. And then, you know, COVID happened. So we took the time of that pandemic to put the book together.
I guess I'll just add to that. One of the things that we noticed was that getting people acquainted with this field is challenging, because mm-hmm. The concepts are big and unorthodox. And, mm-hmm. So trying to introduce people, there's a lot of startup costs that go into learning about ecological psychology. And I guess we were looking to reduce those. We were trying to make it so that there is an easier way in, rather than trying to decipher really technical papers or difficult chapters. We wanted to have an easy on-ramp for our discipline.
The startup costs were high. That's a good way of putting it, because I remember my own introduction to the field very much felt like that, where, you know, I was determined, I wanted this info, and it still took a lot of years and a lot of reading to really fully get my hands around all of it. And it would have been nice to have, like you say, an easier on ramp. So I like the way you put that.
Well, I really think you've both nailed it. And again, I can relate to that, because when I started dipping my toes in this space, and I heard you were also on the Rob Gray Perception Action podcast, I listened to your interview several times with him, and it is tough. It's tough because there seems to be so much wonderful research and data sitting on the shelves of the lab, and it's really hard to get onto the mats and into the sports halls and get it into the coaches. And one of my endeavors is not only learning myself, but trying to be an intermediate and help get it from the academia to the practical side. So I think you did a wonderful job. I think the narrative and the story, that how the book unfolded, was very good. And we spoke a little about intuitions. I think a lot of it's very intuitive, but paradoxically, it also goes very much against what we've learned and what we grew up with and how things were delivered to us at school, especially in sport. And I don't think this doesn't just pertain to my sport or any other sport. This is life, right? We're going to get talk about today and how we see life and how we move through the world. So I don't think it's a huge jump to start thinking more from an ecological perspective, but there's so much unlearning to do and so much of an unwinding of ingrained beliefs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a very good point. And what's funny is that if you talk to the layperson who's never tried to poke at any of these things, they might actually have an easier time understanding the field, because, like you say, they don't have to do as much unlearning. Whereas if you go to anyone who's spent sort of any time in psychology or any other science where you're studying the human, you know, there's this centuries of this established thought of dualism, where you have the body and the mind as being two separate things, and that mind is the central executive, and that idea is just everywhere in all of these different sciences that study people. And so anybody who's sort of spent some time in that, you have to first unlearn everything.
Yeah.
If you're talking to the layperson, everything we say sounds so intuitive because it is, because we're talking about describing perceptual experience from the actual organism's perspective. So you're like, oh, look, that cup lets you pick it up. The average person's like, yeah, duh. It's the scientist that is going, well, wait a second, the length and width and depth. And, you know, it's, the average person has no trouble with it. At least that's been my experience anyway. I don't know, Jeff, what do you think?
Well, and that was another of our motivations for writing this book, is not only to make it accessible to beginners, but also to sort of show why it's an area worth studying for exactly that reason, because things feel so simple from the inside. That's great, right? And the way I describe it to students sometimes is that, you know, you don't have to think about reaching and picking up objects or walking from here to there, just like you don't have to think about, you know, digestion, right? It's good, right? You don't want to have to think about make it happen. You don't want to have to think about your heart beating. You don't want to have to think about those things. You want them just to happen. And perceiving and acting should be like that too.
So one of the words that jumps out, and I think the two words, the embodied, being embodied and embedded in an environment. And again, once you start to see the world from this way, it's very hard to unsee it. And yeah. So might you do a better job than I always try and do, or I always manage to do, is just describe, when we talk about dualism and the fact that, again, this is very, very intuitive, that we have this mind, we're the marionette, we're the puppeteer of all things happening within our mm-hmm. body. Can you speak to, and my listeners will be a little bit familiar when we talk about the interactions between the environment and the task and the organism, or, you know, the mm-hmm. person, and what we're actually trying to achieve and how we interact with the environment. Can you speak a little bit, or summarize, or give your thoughts on what it means to be embedded and what it means for us to be embodied within ourselves?
Yeah. So thank you. That's a big question. That's a very big question, but it's a good one. And one our field spends a lot of time on. And we spend a lot of time on it because the popular thought, or the previous thought, the classical versions of this do a lot of work to separate, right? So they separate the mind from the body. They separate the organism from the environment. They do a lot of work to draw where those lines are, and then treat some of those. So like in the animal environment, like task space, for example, if you're looking at it from that classical view, the task space, the environment, stays static. And so it's just about engage in this static space. But reality is that task space aren't static. And I think of this when you're thinking about doing a sport like MMA, right? The person that you're fighting against isn't like a pole, right? You're fighting against a person, and they are continuously moving, which means the task space is dynamic, which means that you have to dynamically interact with it. And so you can't actually say, okay, well, we're going to set up a motor program ahead of time and just run it, because the second you hit play on that motor program, it's out of date. It's not going to work anymore. So it has to be this continuous, you know, process. And you can't run a process like that unless that you're understanding the organism is being embedded in that task space as mm-hmm. part of the task space.
Yeah, I have started to dislike the term embodied. When people say, they talk about, well, I study embodied cognition. I study embodied this. And I don't say this, but I want to. I want to say to them, is there any other kind? Like, can you have perception that doesn't occur, like is out of a body, or occurs next to a body? Or can you have cognition that can inanimate objects that don't have a body, can they think? Like, to me, it's like, by definition, it can't be any other way. The processes, and especially behavior. I mean, if behavior, we all agree that behavior has to occur within a body, then it really only makes sense to put the perceiving and cognizing also on equal footing, right? We shouldn't have behavior be something that is embodied, separate. Thinking and perceiving being something that is out of body. So I don't know. I guess I'm becoming a little bit curmudgeonly in my
becoming.
Yeah,
I get a little cantankerous myself about it, and I think we talk a lot about that in the space, and perhaps when there's a little bit of debate going back and forward, like that's perception action is something you're either engaging with or you're not, and we're saying, well, the world's either like this or it's not, right? So regardless of even what, just take a sports example, if it was perhaps, you know, what we maybe consider a decontextualized or uncoupled activity, it's still very much coupled. What we're trying to say now is we're just really coupling to maybe the irrelevant or unnecessary or inferior information. And from my perspective in sport, and I speak about this a lot on my podcast and shows, it's a very, very difficult line to walk to be being authentically engaged with my sport and still being ethical and not causing a lot of damage and injury. So I'll leave that for all the other episodes. But I think you're right. And I think what Dr. Wagman was saying there is it never switches off. This is either the way the world is. And I think what your book has done is given a very, very clear and concise body of evidence to say this is more than likely the best evidence where it points right now. And this is how we interact with the world. Now, before we go into, do you have anything to add to that?
No, it's just a thought that occurred to me while you were talking about it. It's a little bit off topic, but I was thinking about how, you know, it never turns off. And the experience that you had while reading the book was immediately to see the applications for the study of what you study, right? You're looking at this sport and you're looking at that. And I had the exact same experience, except I applied it to film studies because that's what I'm interested in. And I know somebody else who read it and had immediate thoughts about social interactions. And I think that is what is sort of great about our field, is that we're saying it never stops. It never changes. This is the way it always is. You're going to pick up this same perceptual system and you're going to put it into that situation. So whatever situation you're interested in studying, you have to study the person like this because the person is like this. And that's always going to be the case. So I just was thinking about how that's sort of an interesting outcome, is that everybody ends up seeing whatever their field is in this.
Yeah. No, and I think it's great because it transcends everything. I think this would be a good time to bring in a fourth member here, and that is the lead character, young Fred. you did all the artwork, I believe.
I did, yes. Okay. I drew all of them.
Weren't an art major then. I love it.
No, but my mother is an artist. And so I learned a lot of art stuff from her. And actually, when I got stuck on a couple of them, I went to my mom and said, "Mom, I don't know how to make this thing look 3D. What am I doing wrong?" And she helped. So
no, I love the simplicity. So the book kind of covers, and there's a narrative. It starts out with Fred wants an apple and he's in the field and whatnot. So I hate to, you know, simplify this or dumb it down too much, but put it kind of in a nutshell. What we're saying in ecological psychology is that we see the world as it is. What cognitive psychology seems to suggest, feel free to jump in where I'm wrong here, that there's a lot of mental processing, cognition, that's, you know, baked into the pie, that we see the world in it as maybe inferior, or we have to do a lot of calculations in our head and processing in our head to make sense of the world. What you're saying as ecological psychologists and authors of this book is we see the world as it is. Can you speak a little to that?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, I want to go back to the example I gave before. Everyone agrees that we behave directly, right? So you are standing on the ground, or you grab a coffee cup, or you're doing it directly. You have direct physical contact with, or if you're fighting with someone, you have direct physical contact. You have a hold of them. But yet when we talk about how you can see that person or see that coffee cup or see that ground, we say you have somehow indirect contact. And that's, to me, what ecological psychology removes. It says, no, they're both direct. It's about the traditional perspective says there's some sort of in-between thing, a mental representation, or in the something that sits between the person and the world that adds to the person's experience, that takes ambiguous stimulation and disambiguates it. Mm-hmm. And I also wouldn't necessarily say that ecological psychology says we see the world as it is. I think ecological psychology says we see the world by means directly, but only by means of meaningful stimulation patterns. Because there's things about the world that I can't see, right? I don't see
UV light.
Know. Yeah,
okay. UV light. You don't see infrared. And
that was an important correction there, yeah, because we see what our perceptual apparatus affords us.
Yeah. I was actually just talking to my mom about this. And I was saying, you know, our perceptual system isn't in the business of giving us a perfect representation of the world. Like, that's not its job. Its job is to help us navigate the world. Its job is to help me walk down my stairs without falling. Its job is to help me pick up a coffee cup and drink it. So it's going to do its job well. And if you measure it by its ability to give you a perfect representation of the world, it's going to look like it's bad at its job. But that's not its job. Its job is to help us fight, right? And notice I can reach that person to punch them. I mean, I'm making guesses because I don't do sports. But, you know, I can reach that person. I can get closer. I can move away and they won't be able to punch me, right? That's what our perceptual system needs to be able to do. And it's very, very good at that because it is looking for the things it needs to do that. If you try and have it looking for things that we don't actually need, then yeah, it's terrible at that.
Yeah, and I think I was guilty there speaking a little quick and even saying seeing the world as it is. It's not seeing as it is, it's feeling, it's touching, it's sensing, it's all our sensory apparatus. And I think it's probably a good thing that we take it for granted, because I think you mentioned, Dr. Wagman, to your students, just the mere act of picking up a cup is like mind-bogglingly amazing what's going on just to do that. And even reading from the book, the mere action of standing upright, there's so much going on that we take for granted. So there was a couple of talking points I wanted to flesh out today. You make, and maybe make this a little bit, how you do a good job of delivering this over to some of my listeners, is you speak a little about the central executive. Is there any synonyms you feel that's known in more popular culture of what we might call that? Is it, you know, you spoke a bit about dualism and stuff, but could you talk a little bit about the central executive and why that may be flawed from a traditional approach?
So there's a ton of synonyms for that word. And if you look historically, it's been given many different names. So the soul is the first, right? And it has a very religious connotation. And Descartes separated the body and the soul, not because he necessarily believed there were two things, but because he wanted to be able to study the body. And the church wouldn't let him because they considered the soul to be divine, right? And so they didn't want him studying the body because they considered it part. And he goes, oh, well, wait a second. It's just two things then. There's the body and the soul is divine, but the body is profane. So we can study that, right? So the soul is the first thing that gets called that. But then also the mind, the central executive, the homunculus, which is, Jeff, is it Greek or is it Latin for a little man? Latin?
That's a really good question.
It's one of those old languages.
Yeah, there's the ghost in the machine.
Ghost in the machine's another one. But they all boil down to the same concept. It kind of doesn't matter what you call it. It's still this idea that you are sitting, that the I that is I, right? The consciousness, the feeling of yourself is somehow sitting behind your eyes in your brain somewhere directing traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And
I like that analogy, yeah.
And it feels like, it kind of feels that way sometimes, right? It does feel like you're sitting in your head behind your eyes.
Oh, it feels like it so much.
It feels like it's so much. And I know that. But the truth is that when you start really digging into that and when you start really pushing out, okay, well, then what does that ultimately mean? If you start looking at it, then you kind of go, well, wait a second, you can't really make that story fly. So what we say is that it's the consciousness, that feeling of yourself, that is an an emergent property of your system, and that that system includes everything. It includes yourself, but also your environment and your task and, you know, your intentions and all of that, from the interaction between all of those things, the constraints of those things, the feeling of consciousness is an emergent property of that.
If your eyes were in your feet, would you still feel like you were behind?
Would you
feel like you're in your head, or would you feel like you're in your feet?
That's a good question.
I don't know. I mean, I think you'd sort of feel in your feet. I don't know. I think the fact that your eyes and your brain are so close together has created this conundrum that it feels like you're behind. I really do think it has to do with where your perceptual systems are.
What about for people who are visually impaired, right? If they don't have the eyes to see through, where do they feel like they are? If it's not behind the eyes, do they maybe feel like they're in their hands? I have questions.
Well, that's my first rabbit hole to pull me down, because we just have a new teammate who was congenitally blind, and he's managed to, he moved from Atlanta recently, and he's managed to become fairly competent at the grappling and wrestling side of things, given all that. And it's really fascinating just to find what is a mind's eye to him. I don't know.
Yeah, you should ask him.
Well, I'm getting to know him. I wasn't ready to pounce on him and ask for all these things. But,
Tell him we need to know. Tell him we're asking.
this is a little bit of an aside. First off, I would imagine that once he gets an opponent on the ground and they're on the ground together, he may have an advantage. I mean, that's a really, that, you know, when you're standing and trying to dodge punches, that might be a problem. But once you're on the ground together, I think, and there are, you can find examples of this all over the internet. There are wonderful examples of people who are blind who do amazing things, like ride bikes, ski, rock climb. They do things where you're like, there's no way, but it's because they've just become especially good at detecting the meaningful stimulation patterns in other forms, just not by light.
Yeah, it's really, and what's really fascinating about it, we actually use that as a task constraint sometimes. I'll have my athletes, again, we're not going to punch and kick each other, but when they're in the wrestling engagements, we encourage them to close their eyes and you know, just kind of experience and how things feel. But when he came to our school, this just shows you how pervasive the whole traditional model is. He was concerned that we weren't maybe explaining or walking him through certain techniques and that so much. And I said, this is the perfect place for you, because we just get on and we learn by doing, by little task objectives. So it's really fascinating. And I'll circle back and let you know once he maybe answers a couple of these questions. So another word that jumps out a lot, features a lot in the book, is that of affordances, opportunities for action. And this is something I'm still a little bit, I struggle a little bit too, when I scratch down and get a bit deeper, the role of meaning, how one attaches and creates meaning within the world. And I have a friend of mine, we were discussing it yesterday. I did want to ask you, where does this, and we'll get onto that. This is a two-part question. Where does the meaning reside?
Okay. So meaning just exists, right? You don't have to create it. You said back there, creating it or attaching meaning. Meaning just exists already. It exists in the interaction between the organism and its environment. So if I'm talking about picking up a coffee cup, that cup has the meaning of pick-upable for me. And it may not have the meaning of pick-upable for my niece, who's an infant and whose hands are not, you know, capable of picking up a coffee cup, or it may not have that meaning for my cat who lacks opposable thumbs, but that doesn't mean that meaning doesn't exist there for me, right? And so this is one of the things we say in ecological law, is that affordances are meaning, right? When we say that you're detecting affordances, we're saying you are detecting the meaning of the environment. And that is inherently in the organism-environment relationship.
That was a very, very clear and concise answer. I think I spoke too fast. I use meaning, and I, when I spoke to my friend last night, it was actually intention, the word we used. And we wondered where intention comes from, where intention maybe resides.
Well, I think intention is behaviors, all phenomena have constraints. And intention is just an extraordinary constraint. Mm-hmm. So it is you are intention changes. I guess this is where we want to talk. We want to avoid the central executive, that intention doesn't really create a pattern. What intention does is just shift one pattern to another. It just tilts the layout of attractors, right? So you transition from one behavior to another based on intention. Intention doesn't, and this is something we talk about later. We talk about dynamic systems and complex patterns or complex systems, that it's never the case. Hopefully this comes out right. It's never the case that something comes from nothing. It's always the case that something comes from something else. And so what intention does is just shift the something becoming something else. And so when you think about it that way, intention has a lot less to do. Intention doesn't have to generate or create or emerge. It just sort of has to tug a little bit.
Yeah.
To send, you one way or the other, or to if you're walking and you want to, I want to avoid that. There's a hole in the ground. Okay. Well, there's just a little tilt and it just has to tip. And that just that little tip is enough to get you moving in that direction or that direction, or to pick up this thing instead of that thing. So where intention comes from is in a, it's sort of the intersection of a whole bunch of things.
Yeah. When I talked about intention, I wrote a paper on how to use these concepts for writing stories. And one of the things I talked about in there was intention as being an emergent property, again, of all of the different constraints that are acting on you, right? So for example, at this moment, I have the constraint of like wanting to do good at my job. And I have the constraint of, worrying about the sales of my book. And so I have these constraints that are changing the way that I'm interacting with this environment right now. But if a lion were to enter my room here, my intentions would immediately shift because the constraints have changed, right? So I would immediately all of my attention would be on the lion. I would completely ignore the Zoom call entirely, right? So the intentions are going to be very much also a product of the environment, organism, relationship, and kind of emerge out of those interactions. So I think of it as being what directs what you end up paying attention to. So in a room right now, there are a million affordances around me, but which ones I'm paying attention to, which ones I'm deciding to engage in, is going to be guided by and constrained by my intentions.
Yeah, I thought a little light bulb just went off for me there, because that's something I've been struggling with. And I was saying, so perhaps when we talk about, I intended this, so I planned for that, that's maybe just a narrative that we tell ourselves.
Sure.
Kind of little story that we tell ourselves, but we're always kind of, again, embedded with and interacting with our environment. And these intentions can be like transient and ebbing and flowing and longer term and stuff. So
yeah, because we all
if
like
I got anything
long-term
out of this podcast today, that was something that really hit me.
Because we all have like a long-term overriding intention, like stay alive, right? That may not be the most important thing, right? Because at this moment, nothing is threatening my ability to live. But if something came in, like that's always an intention I have. But maybe we have shorter term intentions like, oop, don't fall down the stairs as my foot slips off, right? So like you say, the intention that we talk about when we talk about it narratively, when we talk about it retrospectively, like, this is what I was going through, this is what I was thinking about, is never going to be as complex as the reality in the moment for exactly what you're talking about, right? It comes and goes and changes and with the constraints of the situation.
So almost goes now, sorry, Dr. Wyman.
I think intentions become a lot less spooky and a lot less ghostly when we concede that perceiving and acting is embodied and is embedded, that there are constraints already in place that have limited the what seem to be countless possibilities into a manageable number. And intention is just prioritizing some over others. Yeah. And I also think that intention also seems kind of spooky and ghostly because it seems like there's an end directedness. There's a goal that and nature doesn't, you know, only animals and especially only people have goals, but there are goal states in all of nature.
Yeah.
There's certain states are preferred over other states. Ball, you know, stones roll downhill. That's just that it's not the stone doesn't have an intention to do it, but that it is going to end up there unless there are things that prevent it. And I think that's what intentions are. They are the things that prevent or change outcomes that would ordinarily be occurring.
Hmm. I like that.
And we talk about, the difficulty or the challenge in just standing up. And we often think that walking is a difficult task, and it is, but it's really just controlled falling. Mm-hmm. So you lift your foot up the ground and lean, and gravity is going to take you down.
Yeah.
You need to swing your foot and swing your foot, put it down. And it's just a little movement of your leg will keep you from falling. And then you just shift your body again and you move, the next step occurs. And so intentions are just these it gets the right kick at the right time to get the system to fall one way or the other, or to complement the forces that are already provided and turn them into the forces that you need. And that's another way to bring it back to MMA, right? So it's sort of like, I'm going to mix up my martial arts, but one of the martial arts, probably judo, is where you take your opponent's momentum, right? And use it against them.
Yeah, I think that's what this most is. Martial arts, yeah, have an element of that, yeah.
So that's what intention is. Intention is just modifying an ongoing activity to turn it into, to bring about the outcome you want. Right, your opponent swinging at you. You didn't cause the swing, but you're just gonna grab their arm in such a way that they're gonna take them down. The force is being generated by them. The momentum's coming from them, and you're just changing the balance. I'm not sure what I'm talking about, but you're just changing the balance or changing something. And that's what intention is. It's just a little. You just need a little change in center of mass, and down you go.
Let's stick on that a little bit and maybe bring it into a bit more of the striking element, which is the punching and kicking in sport. And what's happening when, say, Fred and I forget the other names of the book, if they were getting ready to learn how to fight, their opponent becomes, and it's transient and it ebbs and flows, becomes kickable, becomes punchable. These little targets become, blockable and missable and all these things, right? The ubbles. I like how we tack that onto words. And that folds in nicely to the next question. The role of kind of experience. I was fascinated what you were speaking to with Dr. Gray about the role of memory, Dr. Wagman. And it's someone it's one of the things that I'm finding it hard to shake, because we talk about memorizing thing and having knowledge about things. And it's really hard for me to kind of shake off. But as someone progresses, can you talk a little bit about the role of what experience plays? So perhaps just say we were eyeing up together to fight each other. I'd find more opportunities to punch and kick you than you would to me. And what's going on there? And how does that develop over time? And what's the role of experience there? Did that make any sense?
I'm going to hand that one to you, Jeff.
Okay. Well, I have a few things I thought about. So the expert, I think, has developed the ability to detect kind of finer grained patterns of stimulation.
Okay.
Right? They are better at picking up on, like, the person who's blind and can rock climb, or blind and can ride a bicycle, or blind and can grapple. They have picked up on the lawful relationships that are always present, but they've become better at detecting them they're better at detecting the sort of subtleties within them. And so that's what expertise does. Expertise allows you to detect the subtleties. And it also allows you to become more efficient in your movements. exactly where to provide the right additional forces.
And this would be the calibration aspect, yes?
Yeah. So it allows you...
We tend to call it attunement.
Attunement to the stimulation patterns that are informative. But also on the movement side, one of the things that that people do when they're unskilled is they try to control everything because there's no other way to get the outcome. And I have to control every aspect of this movement to get it to where I need it to be. But it turns out that what happens with an expert is they figure out what they they shrink down what they need to control. They figure, I only need to control this, this, and this. And if I can do that and let everything else just fall into place. And that's what the expert is doing, is figuring out those little tweaks rather than the larger scale, controlling everything. As far as memory goes, lots of systems are influenced by what happens previously, right? I mean, the weather, what happened, weather today has a lot to do with the weather yesterday, but also has a lot to do with the weather last month. You know, there's a hurricane and 2 months ago that created this particular pattern that led to this particular pattern today. So there's a lot of patterns emerging based on pattern from that are in long time scales. And that's really all that memory is. Memory is you can detect information about the past in the present.
Right. And we don't expect clouds to have a central executive, but yet somehow they are still based on what came before, just like everything else.
This is when people who are listening are really struggling, because I've been trying to bend my mind around this and it's making, I'm not going to say complete sense to me, it's making increasing sense to me when you put it like that.
Let me give you another metaphor that might hit closer to home for some of the listeners who are doing what you do. So let's imagine that I'm not like super in shape. Mm-hmm. That's just true. And let's say I decide to go and I decide to start learning how to do fighting, right? And I come into the gym and I work out. I do it every day for a while. And then I get in shape. So my muscles are now stronger, right? I maybe can run for longer without getting out of breath. I've changed my body because of the things that I've done. And you can think about it like my body carries a memory of what I have been doing for the last couple of months, right? My muscles are stronger because I engaged in that thing. I have changed because of that thing. We make it spooky when we talk about the things like remembering going over to your sister's house. But the truth is it's exactly the same, is that some part of my body has changed in response to the things that I have been involved in. And you don't need a spooky central executive telling you what you were doing. It's in your body, right? So that's might be a little bit more of a metaphor that these particular listeners will understand a bit better.
I also think about it this way, so if you're a beginner at a task, you're kind of like in a deep, dark, dense forest. And there's just no, like all you see is trees and leaves and twigs. And it's just, and you just gotta, you're learning this task as you're going. And what I mean by that is you begin to hack yourself out of the forest. So you take your machete, you start I just gotta get from here to there. All right, whack, whack, whack. And you start cutting yourself a path. But that path is still there. The next time you get put in that spot, that path was made and it gets easier. And you take when by walking the path, you're making the path easier to walk the next time. And those paths get made. And there's a memory, the system is changed because of what you did before, which makes it easier to do it again. And it's no different what Julie was just talking about. You've
changed something physically when you engage in an event. And so it makes it easier, like you say that. So even what he's talking about, they're called neural traces, right? We talk about neurons firing, and it makes, like, if neuron A makes neuron B fire, that's going to be easier for those two to fire together again next time, right? And We've even figured out the chemistry of that interaction and why that happens, the same way that we figured out that when you walk through the woods, your feet push down on the ground and tamp down the ground until make it easier to walk on the next time. You know, those interactions don't have to be governed by some outside mystical force. They're just the realities of the way that this system has been set up, right? And our system is set up to remember in that sense, because we engage with something and it changes us physically. So, I mean, I don't know if that makes it a little less spooky, but
it makes it less spooky. And here's another thing it does, because for the longest time now, and again, it's the context and what people actually mean by it. But in our sport, and I'm sure in a lot of sports, they talk about muscle memory. Mm-hmm. And I've been too quick to, and I have to admit this, I've been too quick to push back on that. You know, it's easy to say muscles don't have memories, and it's maybe not, these motor programs aren't happening the way you think they are. But what you're saying is, I maybe have to walk that back quite a bit and say, you know, the system, so to speak, does remember through experience. And in that case, do I have to have a huge, massive apology to the muscle memory crowd?
I mean, I'm not sure that's the phrase we would use for it, because I don't know what phrases people use for that, but I heartily endorse the idea of muscle memory, the way that people talk about it.
I'll edit that out, because, Dr. Blau.
But it's just that we would conceptualize it differently. So Jeff was talking about, you know, the novice versus the expert in these physical tasks. And I'm sorry, I don't know fighting very well, but the research that I read was in dancing. Right. So you have the dancers like learning to do a tango. And when you first see the dancers trying to do the tango, everybody's very stiff and they're holding they're like tensing up every muscle. And then over time, they little by little let go of muscles that they don't actually need to be in charge of to make this action happen. And those things stay in that person's body, right? The figuring out which muscles you need and which ones you don't. The governance of those degrees of freedom, that stays in that person's body once they have learned how to become this, you know, better dancer. And this is why people say, you know, you can see that somebody is a dancer by the way that they walk, because it's changed the way that their body interacts with itself so much that you can see it in something like walking, which is not necessarily a dancing action, but still something, you know, still about moving and controlling degrees of freedom.
Okay, so before I try and backtrack here with a little bit of dignity, exactly what you said there. In fact, we had a discussion last night. One of my more experienced students came to a novice and said, "You know, when you're going to throw that kick, you're pulling back and you're loading." And I said, "This is a feature. This is a feature of the system, not a bug."
Yeah.
Which we were talking about the freezing and then the releasing of degrees of freedom. And I reminded the more experienced guy, this is exactly what you look like. And not to worry, not to think about it. And over time, it's going to calibrate and become more synergistic. I think I'm going to have to go on an apology tour now to a lot of people about the muscle memory thing. But I think in the context that they spoke about muscle memory, is if we just practice this one thing, you know, in an isolated meaning out of context, that we'll be able to fire off and... So come and help me. Again, save me a little bit here.
No, that's different. Doing it out of context is not the same thing, okay. Right? We're talking about a goal-directed behavior. So Bernstein, who is another person that we talk about a lot in our field, talked about repetition without repetition, right? So we talk about this in the book. He looked at somebody who is hammering, right? Repeatedly hammering. Mm-hmm. And experts at this, the tip of the hammer stays in exactly the same spot, or more or less, but the body does not, right? There's a lot more variability in the way that the arm itself is moving. Mm-hmm. And so what the expert does is figure out how to achieve the goal regardless of moment to moment changes, right? So when you think of the reactive forces involved in hammering, there's a lot, right? Because the muscles are pulling on the body, there's gravity. You know, as you move this way, the muscle on the back has to relax in order for that movement to happen, right? There's a lot of reactive forces happening in something as simple as hammering. So if you tried to, you know, control those piece by piece, you wouldn't necessarily get the tip of the hammer where you need it. And so the person who's hammering is actually controlling where the tip of the hammer is and figuring out that the rest of those forces sort of take care of themselves. So when you're talking about doing an action over and over and over again, to learn it or to put it into your muscle memory, I'm not sure that would be the best way to go about it. You want to achieve the goal over and over and over again, right? So you want to, whatever that goal may be, yes, you're going to want to do that over and over again in context, not out of context.
Thank you. You saved me a little bit there, because just a little bit. And going back to what Dr. Wagman was saying about the over time, they'll become more sensitive to the information. That's largely implicit and unconscious, right?
Well, we don't draw a distinction between implicit and unconscious and conscious, right? So we're saying it's all sort of one system.
It's all one system. So the role of maybe drawing someone's attention to what they're doing, that can all be baked into the kind of development pie, so to speak.
I think you definitely, so it's okay to draw their attention to what they're doing, but you want to, but you got to be, when you're trying to teach a movement skill, it has to be, it can't be, I don't know, it has to be a holistic kind of explanation. So you can't say, okay, well, when you perform this kick, your left knee has to be at 35 degrees. You have to be squatting so that you're a foot and a half off the ground. You have to be like that. That's never going to happen. You have to sort of say it's going to feel like you're falling over, right? And if you sort of explain it like that, what it feels like, what it looks like, rather than the actual, you know, mechanics of it. I have a friend and a colleague who's in studies kinesiology, and he was talking about hula hooping, right? And that's a really complicated skill. And if you try to teach it to someone, you need to oscillate your hips at this particular frequency, but, you know, or you can say something like, well, just try and throw it with your hips. Mm-hmm. And you go, oh, yeah. I get it. Throw it with my hip. Like, if you can find the right metaphor, find the right way to take all of this complexity and turn it into like a, it feels like this, it looks like this, it that, then, you know, it's the same advice if you're playing baseball or softball or cricket, and the coach says, you got to get under it. Mm-hmm. What they're really describing is, they're describing using information about time to contact. They don't know that. Yeah. The athlete doesn't know that, but it doesn't matter. If you can find the right, because if you can get under it, then you're going to catch it. It doesn't, and they're not talking about how fast you need to run, and I'm talking about, like, you know, where you got to put your hand. It's all about describing the outcome, what the outcome looks like, feels like, sounds like.
So this makes me think of a study that I actually participated in, looking at the acquisition of the skill of throwing a basketball, doing a free throw. And there were two conditions, one where they taught it, where they do what you were talking about, right? Do the motion over and over again, out of context, right? You know, do this over and over again, out of context, which is how they traditionally teach it. And the other was to give us no basketballs. I was in this condition, and only balls of other shapes and sizes and weights. Mm-hmm. And have us throw from all over the place, and just you know, exploring that space with all of this different variability, and then, you know, at the end we'd do a test, and sure enough, the variability group did better at the task, even though we had never touched a basketball during the training. And what the argument behind that is we're looking for invariance. We're looking for things that stay the same regardless of the context, right? In thinking of the hammering example, the tip of the hammer needs to make its way to the nail. That thing has to stay the same every single time, right? There's going to be examples like that for fighting as well. Things that stay the same no matter what the context is. And they're easier to pick up the more experience you have with all of the possible different contexts it could appear in. And so the argument was, it's like, okay, if we vary the context, if we change a lot of things all at once, you're going to do a better job, you're going to more quickly figure out what is the invariant, what is the thing that doesn't change regardless of how heavy the ball is or where you're standing or if it's bigger or smaller, you know, what are the things that don't change regardless of all those context changes. And I'm, you know, I'm not to brag, but I made every single one of my free throws on my test condition. So just saying.
Well, this is great because I was feeling a little, I was feeling a little beaten down with the whole muscle memory thing. And you've really reassured me though, because what underpins our approach, and it's tough because people want the prescriptive instruction. I really don't give any prescriptive instruction. I try to keep the tasks externally focused. And I try to scale the variability depending on the level of the learner.
Yes.
A lot of Gabby Wolf stuff, yeah? So, yes, thank you. You've saved me.
I'm here for you.
I won't be down in the dumps all day. You spoke about the hula hoop situation there, or example, Dr. Wagman. In the book, you also gave the example of juggling. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that feeds really well into the attractor states and how you can't explicitly teach juggling. I love that. I love that part. So could you maybe summarize what went on there with the juggling example?
Yeah, I don't know too much about juggling. I'm really glad you brought up Gabby Wolf, though, because that's exactly where I was going with this sort of stuff where you want to, if you can get the person to focus on the outcome rather than on themselves, performance always, always, always improves. And with the juggling, I think what you want to establish there, you want to get a particular rhythm. Of the movement of your hands and the ball, you have to establish the rhythm. And that's this attractor that we're talking about. There has to be a particular relationship between the amount of time that the ball is in the hand and when the ball is in the air. And it's sort of, I don't think you could teach juggling by saying, okay, now hold the ball for half a second. No, wait, that's too long. 0.6 seconds. And then throw it in the air with this much force so that it reaches this height. Right. Then at the very peak, wait for it to come down. You know, and then, I played drums for a while and took drum lessons. And I remember, my drum instructor would say things like, okay, now at this part, you hit the bass drum with your foot and then you hit the snare drum. And I'd be like, what? He goes, never mind. Just make it go. And I was like, oh, I can do that. Right.
Yeah.
Once, when you think about the outcome and especially a rhythmic outcome with the rhythmic of the juggling or the rhythm of, you know, a combination, if you're going to throw a punch and a kick, rather than explain the particular movements, if you can do, okay, it's got to be boom, boom, or it's got to be, you know, zoop, bam, bam, you know, like that will get it across much better.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the reassuring message here is that, and this ties in nicely to what we're speaking about attractors. So what I remember about the juggling aspect is, I think, if I get this correctly, that the ball ends up in the air. The attractor state is the ball ends up in the air about 70% of the time and the hand 30%, or vice versa and whatnot.
It's some ratio. It doesn't really matter exactly what the ratio is, but the point is to achieve that ratio.
Yeah.
And the larger point is that you can't really prescribe that or give too much instruction. You just have to, to trust that within this dynamic process, this dynamic system, that this attractor state will emerge and develop. And that's, can we say that's probably the same with all kind of either complex and simple skills?
Yeah. And I think, you know, in that case, there's sort of one particular outcome, because we're talking about throwing three balls in one specific state is the way to do that. But it's also worth noting that sometimes there might be more than one attractor state. So there might be more than one outcome for any given task, right? So I cannot think of a single example right now, but right. So some specific outcome, some simple task, there might be two different ways to achieve that task and achieve it equally good. And so I'm just pointing out that it may not be just one attractor state that everybody goes to. It might be more than one and it still achieves the outcome.
Yeah. Again, it's all very reassuring. I'm going to, I'm conscious of your time here. Another fascinating part of the book, when you spoke about instinct, I think this is something anyone who has a pet or watches animals and whatnot can talk about instinct. And I think you mentioned this before, Dr. Wagman, that that perhaps there is no real such thing as instinct. Instinct just is an attractor state that's specific to the species and environment. You gave a couple of examples of that, of animals that we think have a particular instinct, but if you perhaps remove that from their environment early on, that won't appear or emerge. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because that's fascinating.
I think it's much safer to talk about species typical behaviors, right? You know, ducks quack and dogs bark and, you know, beavers make dams, and those are species typical behaviors. Ducks don't make dams and beavers don't bark. And that, but those aren't instincts, and it's different. They're not instincts because, remember, again, patterns don't come from nothing.
Yeah.
Patterns come from something. And the something is other experiences that you might not even be aware of. We often think that, you know, behaviors start when an animal is born, or in the case of an animal like a duck, when it hatches.
Yeah.
But there's stuff that precedes that. There's prenatal development. I don't know what you call it in the duck when it's in the egg, but, you know, there's stuff that's before the thing that you are observing. And to assume that a behavior you're observing emerged from nothing is really strange. There's going to be what we've called, or what other people have called, non-obvious contingencies, things that need to happen before the behavior that you're observing happens, that bear no obvious connection. And because the connection's not obvious, it seems like it came from nowhere.
Yeah.
And is that what we attribute to instinct sometimes?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why the word instinct kind of makes every ecological person like shudder a little bit, because it carries with it that connotation as this like completely unlearned behavior. And I always talk about it, you know, in humans, say talking about it, that like, okay, well, when you're born, you have certain things that you do when you're born, right? You close your hand. Anytime somebody touches your hand, you'll immediately start sucking if anything goes in your mouth, right? There's a couple of things you do that are species typical for humans, but no sperm and egg knows how to do those things, mm-hmm. right? No sperm and egg is going to be clasping something because it doesn't have a hand to clasp. No sperm and egg is going to be sucking on things because it doesn't have a mouth to suck with. So at some point that behavior was learned. It's just that behavior was learned when we didn't have immediate ability to observe the system because it was inside somebody. So, you know, that sucking behavior, we now know that babies learn how to suck and swallow in the womb by sucking and swallowing amniotic fluid, right? So it's just because you can't see it doesn't mean there isn't a cause, right? Just because you didn't think of it doesn't mean that it's not there. There's no such thing as an unlearned behavior.
And this is where my random thoughts go. And I'm certainly not trying to trip you up, but when I read that, I was starting to think, and my mind went to these elaborate dances these songbirds and stuff do. And go, well, where the hell does all that come from? If it's not kind of baked into the pie or instinctual.
It comes from somewhere. It comes from subtle experiences. It comes from, there's a history to every behavior, and the history is sometimes very complicated. Sometimes there are dozens of things that have to have happened, or that dance wouldn't have happened. That's one of the lessons I think of in ecological psychology too, is that the causes are not, first off, patterns come from other patterns. And secondly, they're often not linear. They're often not straight line from A to B. Lots of things. And sometimes when you see what seems to be a straightforward pattern, it's an exception. You know, I tell my students, when I talk about, you know, genes and what they may or may not do, or when I talk about causes too, I will turn the lights on. You know, there we go, turn a light on. And I'll say, what caused the light to go on? And they'll say, well, it was you, you know, your hand or your switch. And I was like, well, maybe. But if the bulb was broken, it wouldn't have gone on. If the switch was broken, it wouldn't have gone on. If the light wasn't plugged in, it wouldn't have gone on. If I didn't pay my electric bill, it wouldn't have gone on. So did any of those things really cause the light? Well, no. They all were necessary.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, but yes, you know, but one thing could prevent it. If I broke the bulb, then that would be the cause of the bulb not going on.
Mm-hmm.
But none of those things individually were the cause of the light going on in the first place. And I think that we identify what is a sufficient cause, and we say that's the necessary, that's it, that's the one, we found it, stop. Whoa. But
there's more there.
Maybe, yeah, there's probably more to it. And instinct, well, I guess instinct isn't quite like that. Instinct is the failure to find a cause and say, well, if we can't find one, it has to be inside the animal. It's got to be there from the beginning if we can't find a cause.
Yeah.
I think anyone who's listened this far, because it's become a bit more philosophical than sporty, but so just a constant reminder of me to not try to think I can outsmart the human body or someone else's body. And we just, I'm starting to learn to trust much more. Let the body do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Kind of trust that and let people be free to explore and whatnot. But this is that's a very tough sell, not just in sport, but in life generally. Where people think there's one variable, there's one particular thing they can do to cheat the entire system and narrow in on one thing.
Well, but it's not like you're letting them explore without any direction, right? It's right. Like what Jeff was saying earlier.
It can feel like that relative to how a sport is typically delivered.
Right. But like what Jeff was saying earlier, where the teacher says, make it sound like this, but that's still instruction. It's just instruction of a different type. It's instruction about outcomes. So you do the same thing. You can say, okay, well, don't just, throw a punch. You're going to throw a punch in such a way that this kind of outcome will happen. I don't know. I don't know enough about fighting, but, if you give them, you're still giving them instruction and they're not exploring the space without any direction.
Sure.
You're showing them like where in the space to look for what they need. So it's not like it's completely without direction. It's just not going to be the kind of direction you're talking about in the classic sense of put your arm here, fold the thumb here, put the push here, move the arm like this. It's not going to be that descriptive because it can't be.
And I think this kind of brings everything to a close nicely because, again, there's an expectation of what people, our society wants when they go to learn a new skill or a new endeavor, a new technique or something. And I think what your book did a wonderful job, not only explaining that, again, what I'm going back to is set some loose tasks, an area of exploration and let people kind of figure out and self-organize and explore. And I think, again, it's been incredibly eye-opening, this book. And I'm still on the early stages. I'm often reminded of the. I know it's a U-shaped curve, but I always feel like I'm on the wherever I am on the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yeah.
Seems I'm always either just past the summit or I'm just coming down on the other side. So I'm not sure where I am there, but the book certainly got me further up or further down in some sort.
Sure.
Whatever that means. Now, your book, Introduction is Ecological Psychology. I have it now on Kindle. I have it on hard copy. Is there any intention to make that into an audiobook? Because this is what all the youngsters are doing now. We want audiobooks.
Jeff, did you ever hear back? Yeah, I know you asked. Did you ever hear back? What did she say?
I did. Our publisher, I think our public, the short story is that our publisher is a publisher of academic books, and those generally are not audiobooks.
Audio.
The audiobooks are more for popular press publishers. They're expensive to produce, and I guess they want to be sure that there's going to be an audience. They said they do it on occasion for their very best sellers. So maybe if we sell enough of these,
there you go.
That might be a possibility.
The other thing I was thinking about with the audiobook is I don't know what you would do with all the pictures. Would you describe them? Would you read? I don't know what you do with all those spreads. That would be the real sticking point for me with an audio version.
I do realize that it probably wasn't ideal for audiobook. The reason I ask, I bought like 20 copies of Rob Gray's book Move and gave them out, and they all came back almost like minted that no one was reading them. But when I started sharing the audiobook, people got a lot out of it. But that was a whole different narration and stuff. So I get that.
Yeah.
You know, Julia, I was thinking it might be useful, it might be nice to have maybe someone with a Scottish accent, maybe, narrate our book.
If I could get through one sentence without mumbling and stumbling, I'd consider it. But that's an enormous achievement for me, probably because I listen to audiobooks too much and not read them.
There you go.
So I reached out to you, and you were, like most people I reach out to, very, very receptive, happy to come on and talk. I really, really appreciate your time today. I'm going to continue to promote your book and share it with everyone I can. I think you've done a wonderful job of making this a very digestible. It's not a super easy read, but it's also, I started out with some of the books and academic papers and whatnot, and they're just, I could chew on them for days. So I think you both did a wonderful job there.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us on here. This was fun.
We are really pleased to have you be so enthusiastic.
Yeah.
You are a true cheerleader and supporter, and we really appreciate it.
I'm definitely a cheerleader, and again, it's my endeavor to take this kind of stuff and help you, because you presumably wrote it for practitioners in the field and people who are interested in starting to explore this. There now, if any of my listeners want to get in touch and perhaps reach out to you, they're welcome to reach out to you and email you.
Of course,
yes, absolutely.
Okay, and is there anything else you'd like to add? Any other upcoming works or resources that you think might be useful that you could point me to that I haven't stumbled across yet?
Jeff?
No, you mentioned you've already read Rob Gray's book. He was someone I thought you should read. So I think if you know about him, that's a really good start as well.
I hear Rob Gray's voice when I go to bed. He's over four. He has over 400 episodes, and I've listened to them multiple times. So that man has taken a lot of my bandwidth up. Thankfully, I think he's doing a wonderful job at what he does there. And to have the kind of the backup, because often when we speak to people, I feel sometimes in my circle, I feel like a bit of a flat earther, because it's a lot of this pushes so much against the conventional wisdom, and so this is why I go right to the top, find out the real academics, the real experts, and it's important for that reassurance.
There's a big group in Europe that does work on this ecological dynamics. A guy named Ludovic Seifert, he's in France. He studies rock climbers.
Okay.
And a group in Portugal as well. So I think those are people you might look into.
They'll be the next group that will reach out to Pestner.
Good luck with your pestering.
Dr. Blau, Dr. Wagman, thank you very much. I very much appreciate your time, and I look forward to maybe keeping in touch. I'm going to give you an update on my man Lucas, our new blind teammate, and I'll give you an update on that. I'll send you a quick mail and just tell you what's in his mind's eye. What is he feeling when he's out there? Okay,
thank you
very much. Thank you very much.